If you had to guess, which continent in the world do you think is the richest in natural resources? And things like oil and minerals and natural gas and precious metals. North America? Europe? Asia? Antarctica? The continent of Africa holds over 30% of the world's known mineral reserves, including such things as cobalt, platinum, uranium, gold, diamonds, as well as significant oil and natural gas reserves. Africa. I never would have guessed that. In addition to mineral reserves, 2018 Foresight Africa report stated that sub-Saharan Africa alone, so south of the Sahara, is home to nearly half of the world's uncultivated land. Half. Uncultivated land that could be brought into production, almost 775,000 square miles of land. It's an area the size of Nebraska in sub-Saharan Africa. Additionally, Africa uses only 2% of its renewable water resources. This is compared to 5% globally. 2%. As a result of all this untapped wealth, Africa has become one of the world's fastest growing regions for foreign direct investment. Companies coming in and wanting to support mining interests and take advantage of those kinds of things and tap into that economy. However, despite being so richly endowed with so many natural resources, and despite booms in both mining and foreign investment, the people of Africa have drawn very little benefit from the natural wealth of the continent that they live on. And it remains one of the poorest areas of the globe, with almost 50% of the population living on less than $1.25 a day. Half of them. The World Bank estimates that 82% of Africans live on less than $4 a day. Four out of five. It's just shy of a billion people. How can a continent with so much natural wealth be so steeped in poverty? It's widely acknowledged and understood by pretty much any organization that researches the topic, and there's been many, that dishonest, incompetent, and flat-out corrupt leadership is to blame for this. Corruption is the scourge of Africa. Nearly every nation, from the lowest levels of public service to the highest offices in the land, the corruption of authority has just simply impoverished the people of Africa. The African Union estimated in 2012, and I bet this number's low, that corruption costs Africa $150 billion a year. This corruption alone. The lowest levels of government, the very lowest levels, bribery is rampant. There's an organization called Transparency International, and they're a global coalition that's dedicated to measuring corruption around the world. And they found that one in four Africans in the past 12 months had to pay bribes to public officials. One in four. And more than any other public service, the police and the courts are most likely to be involved in the bribery. At the highest levels of government, you find heads of state, dictators really, who commonly oppress their people, rig elections, abuse power, pervert justice, and embezzle their nation's funds to enrich themselves, while their people remain in abject poverty. I'll share just a few examples of such dictators just from recent history, though the list is long and infamous. From 1993 to 1998, Nigeria was ruled by a military dictator named Sani Abacha. Mr. Abacha operated a secretive and brutal regime that left Nigeria in absolute poverty. Like so many others, he obtained his power through a military coup and then issued decrees that gave him absolute power by placing the authority of his government over that of the courts, the legal system, everything. He also issued a decree that allowed him to imprison anyone for 3 months without trial. If he didn't like someone, he just had them locked up. No charges necessary. Human rights abuses were rampant during Mr. Ibaka's tenure, as he was known to kill or imprison any political opposition to his control. Torture and lengthy imprisonment for even minor crimes were common. Mr. Ibaka's regime would even imprison the innocent relatives of wanted fugitives, simply to convince those fugitives to turn themselves in. When he died in 1998, after 5 years in power, Sani Ibaka's net worth was estimated at $20 billion. It's almost two-thirds of Nigeria's entire GDP for that year. José Eduardo dos Santos ruled the country of Angola from 1979 until 2017, until very recently. During his reign, dos Santos actually boosted the Angolan economy through the development of their oil and diamond industries. However, though the economy of Angola grew, the wealth of its citizens remained stagnant, didn't change. Almost 70% of the population of Angola subsisted on only $2 a day, while the government budget grew by tens of billions of dollars. The reason for this was revealed when a 2011 audit by the International Monetary Fund showed that $32 billion of Angola's money had simply disappeared from the official records. Simply disappeared, a quarter of the nation's income. At the end of his rule in 2017, Dos Santos had estimated net worth of $20 billion, and his daughter had a net worth of $3.8 billion. Francisco Nkema reigned over Equatorial New Guinea from 1968 to 1979. Mr. Nkema was extremely paranoid, so he ruled his country from a hut in his ancestral village, a hut where he kept the entirety of the national treasury, stuffed away in suitcases, tucked under his bed. Just 3 years into his rulership, Nkema declared that anyone who threatened the president or the government would be punished with death. Simply insulting the president or his cabinet resulted in 30 years in prison. During his 11-year tenure, nearly a third of the country's population was either killed or exiled. One last one, Robert Mugabe, probably most well-known of all these dictators. Robert Mugabe became president of Zimbabwe in 1987. As soon as he entered office, President Mugabe consolidated his power by creating a single-party state. He abolished all other political parties. He employed a North Korean-trained security force to deal with dissidents. And he gave himself the power to dissolve parliament and declare martial law. He retained a brutal iron grip over Zimbabwe for 30 years by looting the diamond deposits, rigging elections, and torturing and killing those who supported his political opponents. As I researched this message, I was stunned at just the sheer amount of leaders, the laundry list of leaders, just like these few that we talked about. Just like these who'd ruled all these different countries in Africa, just in recent history, in modern times, well within most of our memories. It's truly tragic how the misrule in Africa has been. We could easily spend the rest of this message just reading through all the examples of corrupt and cruel and incompetent leadership that has held Africa in bondage over the last 50 years, talking about all the violent coups and military dictatorships and rigged elections and even genocides that continue to this day. Let's turn to the book of Proverbs. Let's turn to chapter 29. Proverbs 29, and we'll read verse 2. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. How many of the world's problems, not just in Africa, but in the entire world, are caused by corrupt people in authority, by abusers of power, by cruel despots, crooked politicians, police, and judges. We spent a little time today focusing in on modern-day Africa, but is man's history and the rest of the world really that much better? When we look back at all the great rulers in history, isn't it essentially a laundry list of corrupt, power-hungry politicians and warmongers? Bloody men and women who took and held power through violence and fear? When we look back at man's track record for leadership, it really begs the question, what good is it to have leaders? Why should anyone be given authority over others when leaders routinely cause so much suffering for their people? Why does anyone need to be in authority? Why not just abolish it altogether? Why not establish a society where no one had authority over anyone else? That way, no one would have the power to abuse authority through unjust laws or selfish ambition, or perverted justice, and cruel punishment. Why can't we have a world where no one is in charge? Where you were your only boss? Wouldn't that be utopia? Wouldn't that be a perfect world? There's an ideology that exists today that asks these very questions and strongly believes that we should abolish all authority. And this ideology in our modern time has been growing in its number of adherents. We call them anarchists. Anarchy is defined as the absence of authority, the absence of government. Or if you're an anarchist, you might say that anarchy is a utopian society of individuals who enjoy complete freedom without any form of government. So one quote from the father of Russian anarchism put it, a gentleman by the name of Mikhail Bakunin said, "The trouble lies not in any particular form of government, but in the very existence of government itself." But what would the world be like without any form of government, without any form of authority, without anyone having the power to create or enforce laws? In the Bible, we actually have a rather detailed example of this. There's an entire book that describes a time when the Israelites lived, for most part, in a state of anarchy. Let's turn to the book of Judges. Book of Judges, chapter 21, and we'll read verse 25. Judges 21, 25. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." The same statement is repeated also in Judges 17:6 for your notes. It's Judges 17:6. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They didn't submit to God's authority or kings or anyone's for that matter. Each person decided for themselves what was right and wrong and did as they saw fit. And what was the result? Was it a utopian society of individuals who enjoyed complete freedom without any form of government? No. It was chaos. During the time of the judges, the Israelites were routinely invaded by neighboring peoples. They were killed, taken captive, enslaved, put under foreign domination and oppression. And to save them, God had to appoint judges time and again to help Israel overthrow those who oppressed them. But after the judge came and went, and their authority dissipated, Israel would slide back into anarchy, everyone doing what was right in their own eyes. Authority is not something that can be abolished. It's not something that can be destroyed or gotten rid of. It always exists. Someone always has it. It's just a question of who has it and how well do they wield it? From the absolute rule of one man to the anarchical rule of every man for himself, mankind has tried pretty much every form of government that you can conceive of. And every one has failed to establish the fair, just, righteous, utopian society that mankind has pursued since the creation. Why? Why is that? Let's look at the book of Jeremiah. I'll turn to chapter 10 and verse 23. Jeremiah 10 and verse 23. Jeremiah 10, 23. O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. You might also reference Proverbs 14:12, which says, there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. The entire history of man since the creation has been an experiment in man's ability to discern right from wrong, good from evil, on our own. And we have only ever demonstrated the truth of these verses that we just read. Authority always exists. It must exist. There must be someone or some ones who have the power to establish laws and delineate right from wrong, to teach people the law, to make decisions and judgments, and to enforce the law. And someday, those some ones will be us. Let's go to Revelation 20, and verse 4. Revelation 20 and verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. You and I are being called to great authority, to reign over the earth with Christ for 1,000 years. So how can we, who have been called to be kings and priests in God's coming kingdom, how can we prepare ourselves to receive this authority? How can we ensure that we don't repeat the cycle of all mankind's leaders down through history? What makes someone worthy of authority? What will make us worthy of authority in God's kingdom? This is what I'd like to dig into for the rest of my time today, to analyze the qualities that we need to develop within ourselves in order to show ourselves worthy of the authority that we are being offered. 4 qualities of those who are worthy of authority. 4 qualities of those who are worthy of authority. And the first quality that we'll look at, first quality someone must develop to be worthy of authority, is that of humble service. Humble service. Like so many words we find in the Bible, the word authority isn't defined in our modern society exactly as it is in the Bible. It doesn't mean the same thing to our modern society as it does within the pages of the Bible. So it's important for us to understand what God means when he talks about authority versus how man perceives authority. When I did a Google search on the definition of authority, it came back with this. It said, authority is the power or right to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience. Synonyms being power, command, control, mastery, dominion, rule, and supremacy. When you look at Webster's and other dictionaries, you find very similar definitions to this. But But these definitions almost always lack a critical element that God includes when he defines authority. And we find that in the Gospel of Mark. Let's turn to Mark chapter 10. And we'll start reading in verse 35. Mark chapter 10 and verse 35. It says, "Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus, saying, 'Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask.' And he said to them, 'What do you want me to do for you?' They said to him, 'Grant us that we may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left, in your glory.' But Jesus said to them, 'You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?' They said to him, 'We are able.' So Jesus said to them, 'You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared.' And when the 10 heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. But Jesus called them to himself and said to them, 'You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many.'" Nowhere in that dictionary definition that we read on authority does it say anything about service. But Christ says here that authority is supposed to be a service. And this is a critical thing for us to understand, because to prepare ourselves for authority, we need to have a proper understanding of what good authority really is. Authority is about serving those who are under your authority, caring for and prioritizing their needs before your own, not exploiting them for your own desires. Let's look at another critical aspect of godly authority that's missing from a lot of the dictionary definitions we read today. Let's turn to Matthew 24. We'll read verse 45. Matthew 24 and verse 45. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household, to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, 'My master is delaying his coming,' and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." More often than not, when people look at authority, they see it as a right, as a power. They think, "Oh, how wonderful it would be to have all that power and that prestige and that privilege." And they fail to recognize what Christ highlights for us in this passage, that authority is first a responsibility. It's a responsibility. The master in this passage gave the servant authority in order to provide for those under his care. Godly authority is the responsibility to serve, not the right to take. It is to be a position of humble service, not one of exalted prestige. And how much better How much better of a place would this world be if our leaders simply understood and adhered to this one definition? They saw authority as a responsibility to serve those who depend on them instead of an opportunity for personal gain. The Bible shows us that a nation is richly blessed when its leaders see their authority as the responsibility to serve that it is and humble their hearts at this realization. Let's turn to a prime example of this in 1 Kings. We'll read chapter 3. 1 Kings 3, starting in verse 4. First Kings 3:4. Now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" And Solomon said, "You have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" The speech pleased the Lord. Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, "Because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but has asked for yourself understanding to discern justice, behold, I have done according to your word. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days." As a result of Solomon's humble request, God blessed the nation of Israel immensely. Read through those chapters and verses of Solomon's reign, and it's incredible the prosperity they enjoyed. The peace is truly their golden age of peace and prosperity, and it lasted for 50 years. When the righteous rule, the people most certainly do rejoice. This is the heart, and that is the approach we need to have if we are to show ourselves worthy of authority. To see it as the responsibility that it is, and develop within ourselves the character of humble service. And with this character in place within us, we can begin to develop another quality. Another quality we need to prepare ourselves for authority. And that is wisdom. Wisdom. The ability to see the truth, discern right from wrong, good from evil. Wisdom. In 2014, Pew Research conducted a survey on the changing of religious views in America. And one of the key findings in that survey, if you dig through the results, was that there was an incredible increase in the amount of people in the U.S. who might identify themselves as humanists. People basically who say they're either an atheist, not believing in God, or an agnostic, or not sure that they believe in God or not. Incredible increase. So 12% of all Americans surveyed claimed that they were either atheist or agnostic. However, among millennials, this number is 29%, almost 1 in 3. The American Humanist Association, which was established about 75 years ago, has this as their stated mission on their website. It says their stated mission is to strive to bring about a progressive society where being good without a God is an accepted and respected way to live life. We are accomplishing this through our defense of civil liberties and secular governance, by our outreach to the growing number of people without traditional religious faith, and through a continued refinement and advancement of the humanist worldview. Humanism encompasses a variety of non-theistic views: atheism, agnosticism, rationalism, naturalism, secularism, and so forth, while adding the important element of a comprehensive worldview and set of ethical values, values that are grounded in the philosophy of the Enlightenment, informed by scientific knowledge, and driven by a desire to meet the needs of people in the here and now. In other words, humanists believe that man has the ability to discern and define right and wrong, what is good and evil, and that we also have the capability to establish a society that's ethical all on our own, to bring utopia to pass on our own. Let's turn to Genesis 3. Genesis 3, and we'll start reading verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, 'You shall not eat of every tree of the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, 'You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" And the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Humanists believe that through the application of human reasoning, that mankind can know the difference between good and evil by himself, can figure it out. In other words, they've fallen for one of the oldest recorded lies in history. You will be like God, knowing good and evil, discerning good from evil. God allowed Adam and Eve to eat the fruit of all trees, including the tree of life, but not the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Eating the fruit of the tree of life represents the choice to rely on God to teach us what is good and evil, you know, through his law and his spirit, to trust that he has the wisdom and authority discern right from wrong, and to submit to that. Eating the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil represents human beings choosing for themselves what is good and what is evil, giving ourselves the authority to discern and define what is right and what is wrong. Let's look at Proverbs verse 1, or chapter 1, excuse me. Proverbs 1. In verse 2. Proverbs 1 in verse 2. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity. To give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Wisdom comes from God. It's taught by him to those who place their trust in him. It's not in man to discern or define what is good and evil on his own. Wisdom must be taught to us, must be taught to us by the only one who has it. Let's also turn to Matthew 7 and verse 13. Matthew 7:13. It says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. In the Humanist Manifesto, it states that humanists believe that, quote, knowledge of the world is derived by observation, experimentation, and rational analysis. And also, quote, ethical values are derived from human need and interest as tested by experience. Man has been experimenting with right and wrong for thousands of years. What have we observed from these experiments? What have the results shown? What is the rational conclusion we should reach based on those observations and results? For thousands of years, mankind has been choosing the broad way, described in Matthew 7, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in our attempt to discern right from wrong for ourselves. And where has it gotten us? What are the results? What's the death toll? How much suffering has it caused? What example can we point to of a government that got it right? Had perfect laws and justice. The broad way, the way of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, always has led us to where God said it would lead us, to death. Leo Tolstoy, the famous Russian author of War and Peace, has the following quote, which I found to be rather insightful regarding this. He said, all the methods of appointing authorities that have been tried, divine right and election, and heredity and balloting, and assemblies and parliaments and senate, all have proved ineffectual. Everyone knows that not one of these methods attains the aim either of entrusting power only to the incorruptible or of preventing power from being abused. Everyone knows, on the contrary, that men in authority, be they emperors, ministers, governors, or police officers, are always, simply from the possession of power, more liable to be demoralized, that is, to subordinate public interests to their personal aims, than those who have not the power to do so. Indeed, it could not be otherwise. How much more experimentation, observation, and evidence do we need? How many more millennia must mankind suffer under misrule before admitting that the ability to discern right from wrong isn't in us? Such discernment only comes from God. Let's turn to one last passage on this point in Deuteronomy. We'll break into the passage laying out God's instructions for Israelite kings in Deuteronomy 17. In verse 18, God's instructions to the kings of Israel. Deuteronomy 17, verse 18. Also it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. God commanded the kings of Israel to study his word daily so they would have wisdom, so they would know right from wrong and judge righteously. And you and I are called to be literal kings and priests. So we should follow the command in this passage and be studying our Bibles daily as well. It applies to us. For someone to be worthy of authority, they must have the wisdom to discern right from wrong. They need to know what's right and wrong, good and evil. And this wisdom is rooted in the fear of God, not concocted by men. But wisdom alone is not enough. It's not enough to demonstrate oneself worthy of authority. Wisdom must be put into application. So we don't only know what is right, but we do what is right. So the next quality that we'll look at that's necessary for someone to be worthy of authority is to be incorruptible. To be incorruptible. You had warning that I was speaking today, so you should have known you'd be getting at least one ancient history lesson today. Before Rome became an empire, encompassing the entire Mediterranean Sea within its borders, it was first a republic, you know, controlling little more than the boot of Italy. It was a nation-state among many other equally powerful nation-states that were spread around the Mediterranean Sea. It wasn't until Rome defeated the Carthaginians and the famous general Hannibal Barca that they truly started to dominate the Western world. Once they defeated Carthage and its allies, Rome was able to expand from the Italian peninsula to Spain, Portugal, North Africa, the Balkans, southern France, and even parts of Greece. They expanded their territory exponentially. And with all this rapid expansion in territory came an explosion of wealth, especially for Rome's upper class. And with the explosion of wealth came an explosion of corruption. Bribery ran rampant in the final decades of the Roman Republic. It was a major factor contributing to its collapse, as everything and everyone seemed to be up for sale. And everyone knew it. Roman politicians openly bribed, didn't try to hide it even, openly bribed public officials to look the other way. They shamelessly bought votes to obtain political office. Even bragged about bribing judges and jurors to obtain the ruling that they wanted in court. It's recorded that Julius Caesar owed as much as 1,300 talents due to his rampant spending, bribing his way up the political ladder. It's about $1 billion in today's money. Perhaps the most infamous story from this time is about one of Rome's allies, a North African prince by the name of Jugurtha. And this fine gentleman had murdered his brother so he could become the sole ruler of his nation. And when Rome sent an official to mediate in the dispute, Jugurtha bribed them to rule in his favor, knowing how much the Romans loved bribes. But hearing about this back in Rome, the Senate and the People's Assembly, their legislative branches, were outraged. And so they arrested the high official and commanded Jugurtha to come and stand trial in Rome for bribing one of their high officials. So Jugurtha came to Rome. And what did he do when he got there? He bribed his way out of bribery charges. And as he sailed back to his home country, having bought the verdict he wanted, he looked back at Rome and famously stated, "A city for sale and doomed to quick destruction if it should find a buyer." And he was right. The Republic of Rome was rapidly rotting from the inside out. And for the next 100 years, it would be racked by round after round of civil war until the Roman Republic finally collapsed to be replaced by the one-man rule of the Roman Empire. Let's turn to Proverbs. Proverbs 29 and verse 4. Proverbs 29:4. The king establishes the land by justice, but he receives bribes, overthrows it. Justice is the cornerstone of any successful society. When those in authority flout their nation's laws, when they show partiality and prejudice due to greed or selfishness or personal interest, their rulership is not long for this world. Because a nation's laws are the social contract that bind us all together. You know, they are the basis of trust in the government. And when that trust is destroyed, the oppressed will seek to replace the government, form a new one, create a new social contract. And so they'll protest, they'll lead to civil unrest and violence, even coups and civil wars. To be worthy of authority requires a person to do and to judge righteously, to be impartial, incorruptible. Let's turn to Psalms chapter 15. Psalms 15 and verse 1. Psalms 15:1, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. He who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. Incorruptible. For someone to be worthy of authority in God's kingdom, they must not only have the wisdom to discern right from wrong, they must choose right. They must do what is right. One fourth and final point for today. Fourth quality, then. Fourth quality of those worthy of authority is love. Love. If you ever apply for a position of leadership, if you have in your time, you don't get many questions pertaining to love, do you? You don't see love listed as a requirement on many job postings. Now hiring, management position available. Must be loving. Must be long-suffering. Must not be envious. Must not be puffed up or behave rudely. Must not be selfish. Must not be easily provoked. Must think no evil or rejoice in iniquity. Must bear all things, believe all things, hope all things, and endure all things. Expertise with Microsoft Office is a plus. Please apply within. Love is not often among mankind's requirements for positions of authority, but it is always a requirement among God's. In fact, it is the most critical quality that we must have if we are to show ourselves worthy of authority. Let's back up this point by turning to Colossians chapter 3. It's the most critical quality we must have. Colossians 3 and verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Above gentleness and kindness, above humility, patience, and forgiveness, we are told to put on love as the elect of God. As the elect of God, we are to put on love above everything else. Love must be the foundation of our authority. We must put off the selfish desires of our human nature and take up the selflessness and outgoing concern that was demonstrated to us by Christ. And isn't that the crux of this entire matter? Isn't that the root of so many problems with those in authority? All those tyrants that we talked about in the beginning of this message were focused on themselves, their own selfish interests, their own desires, what power and authority could do for them. They didn't have outgoing concern for their needs of their impoverished people. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians 13:1, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become sounding brass or clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Without love, we cannot be worthy of authority. We have all these other things that we listed, that we read. If we don't have love, don't have the love of Christ, we will not be worthy to rule as kings and priests beside him in his kingdom. I think this is why in Ephesians 5:25, husbands are commanded to love their wives first and foremost. Because the family is where authority begins. It's where all authority must be grounded in love, and that's our first experience of authority. Our family is where we all first experience authority. And God wants that first experience to be positive. So he commands husbands first and foremost to love as Christ loved. We are all called to love as Christ loved. To be worthy of authority, you must love those who are under your authority. You must sacrifice for them. You must put their needs above your own. You must be patient. You must be kind. You must be forgiving. Without love, you will never be worthy of authority. So I ask again, what makes someone worthy of authority? The word authority is rooted in the Latin word auctor, which means author, originator, or creator. God is the author, our creator. Authority is his by right as the author of creation, and he gives it to whom he chooses. Only God the Father and Jesus Christ are truly worthy of all authority. So they are without sin. Since the Garden of Eden, mankind, under the influence of Satan, has usurped God's authority. We have chosen to create our own laws, to decide for ourselves what is right and what is wrong, what is good and evil, and who shall rule over us. And God has allowed us to do so, at least for now, so that we might see for ourselves that he was right all along. But taking authority, having authority, does not make us worthy of it. Let's turn to Revelation. Revelation chapter 5. Revelation 5 and verse 1. And I saw on the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll, written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" And no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much, because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. But one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals." And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb, as though it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Then he came and took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth." Only God is worthy of ultimate authority. Not only does he exemplify all these qualities we discussed and much more, not only is he our creator, but he is also our savior. He redeemed us with his own blood. He demonstrates all these qualities we just discussed today better than anyone. You know, who better to rule us? Who better to take on that responsibility? Who better set an example of humble service in Christ, who demonstrated greater wisdom in his judgment than Christ, who was more impartial and incorruptible, who sacrificed more or unjustly suffered more on our behalf than Christ. Authority always exists. It's just a matter of who has it and who is more worthy to have it than Christ. This world yearns to have truly worthy people in authority, to finally be free of the oppression and misrule here in Satan's world. And when that authority comes, the world will flock to it. When it finally comes, let's read one last passage in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2. And we'll start reading in verse 2. Isaiah 2, verse 2. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. What a relief that will be for the people of this world, for all those who have never known righteous authority. During the millennium, mankind will experience loving and just rulership of Christ and his saints, and they will willingly come from far and wide to submit to him, to learn God's laws, and to put them into practice. For God alone is worthy to have all authority, and when we're resurrected, that responsibility of authority, that humble, wise, incorruptible, loving authority, will be placed on our shoulders. We share that burden. For thousands of years, mankind has experimented with authority in our quest to define what is right and wrong for ourselves, to create a just society. And we've tried everything. We've tried absolute dictatorships and anarchy, democracy, socialism, communism and feudalism, tribalism and oligarchy, and all have failed. All will fail until we finally realize that the problem isn't solved with a different form of government, or a new set of human leaders, or a new set of laws. The problem is solved when we accept it is not within us to direct our own way. The broad way of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil has only ever led us to suffering and death. God is the only one worthy of ultimate authority. His way is the only way. His definition of good and evil is the only definition, and only he will decide whom he can trust with authority in his kingdom, who we can trust to be a humble servant, to discern right from wrong, to say the words, this is the way, walk you in it. We can trust to be incorruptible. And above all, who we can trust to love his children as he loves us.